name is Sid, and I'm a veterinarian and from Pullman, Washington. And today I wish to share with you some of my observations and experience with the handicap. And in my reading of Scripture, I found that, that Jesus seemed to have a special concern for the handicap. I'll read you just a couple of verses out of Luke 7, verses 20-22. The messengers made their way to Jesus and said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you. He asks, are you the one who is to come, or are we to expect some other?" There and then he cured many sufferers from diseases, plagues, and evil spirits, and on many blind people he bestowed sight, and then he gave them his answer. "Go," he said, "and tell John what you have seen and heard, how the blind recover their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are made clean, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to life, the poor are hearing the good news, and happy is the man who does not find me a stumbling block." I think those are very significant words. Now, in a way, we are all handicapped. I could list quite a few of mine for you, but we are not here to do that today. And then there are others who are exceedingly handicapped, but you wouldn't know it, and others are very handicapped and are very despondent. I will read you a letter. "I am 16 years old now, and I don't know what to do, and I would appreciate it if you would tell me what to do. When I was a little girl, it was not so bad because I got used to the kids on the block making fun of me. But now I would like to have boyfriends like the other girls and go out on Saturday nights, but no boy will take me because I was born without a nose. Although I am a good dancer, I have a nice shape, and my father buys me pretty clothes. I sit and look at myself all day and cry. I have a big hole in the middle of my face that scares people, even myself, so I can't blame the boys for not wanting to take me out. My mother loves me, but she cries terribly when she looks at me. What did I do to deserve such a terrible bad fate?" And then it goes on. I have had a good deal of experience with the handicap because I was a Norwegian raised in a Swedish community. So I was introduced to many handicapped people to begin life. And so I learned to have special appreciation for them. Seriously, I believe it was inculcated in me by my parents. My mother was especially sensitive to this issue. And there was a lad named Erling who lived up the road from us. He was out in the country. And there was about two farms between us and Erling. Erling was older than I. He was as old as my brother, a couple of years older. But Erling did not do well in school. I don't know fully the nature of his difficulty. He was partially physically handicapped, although he could run, but not real well. You could always hear Erling coming because usually he made quite a bit of noise. He was not just somebody walking down the road coming to school. He usually was a vehicle. He would hold his lunch pail like this, and he'd be steering with his hand, and he'd make noise like a truck, see, or a car. Now and then he'd run into the ditch and spin his wheels and come back out and round the corner. Well, some of us, if we did that, they wouldn't think so much of it, but Erling did it quite a bit. And some days I'm sure he believed that he was a car. And because of this, people would pick on Erling. And this is a small country school. My mother was very sensitive to this, and her parents, and Erling's parents were very sensitive to this, and his brothers and sister. And they were very sensitive about it. And my mother gave out very strict orders. She was a disciplinarian, and there was no way that I better not treat Erling very, very sympathetically. That was also true with my brother. To the extent that I did get into some fights quite young, defending Erling. And this extended not to, because a lot of people didn't like Erling around. But I was to invite Erling to the house. And also I was also ordered to go and play with Erling periodically. Well, I was really quite fond of Erling. And we'd exchange rabbits on Saturdays and we'd go and play in the woods and my brother and I'd go up and play with Erling. And I guess I didn't realize it at the time, the impression this made on his parents. And his mother, who lived to be very, very old, was always very kind to me. And his sister beyond them. In fact, I had an interesting experience. Well, after the war, then I left the place, Stanwood, Washington, and I never came back very much. And my folks moved for a time too, so I lost the sort of contact with Erling. And then they took him to a mental hospital called Buckley, and that was a long ways away. Well, after the war. A few years after the war, when I was in Pomona, I made a special point to go and visit Erling. And I made arrangements ahead of time so I could take him out for a ride and talk to him. And he still recognized me. And we had a very good visit, and it was very fortunate because shortly thereafter he died quite young. And when I gave a special Reformation service in my hometown, his sister, in fact, I guess on three occasions over the last 10 years, his sister, if I was within shouting distance, his sister, who I hadn't seen then for many, many years, she'd always ask if I remembered who she was. But it was exceedingly heartwarming to realize how much it meant to her that I had gone, that I had done just these simple things for Erling. And I'm grateful to my mother for this, although maybe at the time I wasn't fully appreciative of it, especially when I had to defend him with my limited musculature. There was another person in our town named Hoover. Now Hoover was much older than I, and he went to the other school. Hoover was finally moved from the first to the fourth grade because he couldn't get any seats smaller. That's why he was in the fourth grade. He would have stayed in the first, but the seats were too small. He grew quite a bit then. He was very good on the track team, although he didn't fully understand the game. Because he did the long distance running, and he would run faster than most anybody else. Of course, he was older than all of them. And when he got quite a ways ahead, he'd sit down alongside the track, wait for the others to catch up, and then he'd start out again. But people were, again, often cruel and would take advantage of and make fun of Hoover. And this bothered me very much. But in a way, they sort of made up to Hoover in a way, because when his parents died, this town, which is very small, of Stanwood, Washington, they made place for him, and one person who had a business there made provisions for him and kept his accounts, and they got him the Seattle PI route and got him a bicycle. And he was very attentive to his duties as a paper boy. And they took care of him till he died and really looked after him. And I'll always be grateful. And I made a special note to tell this person that I was one who personally appreciated what they did for Hoover. Now, our history as a people has not been very good relative to the handicap. Not long ago, in preparations for my lectures at the University of Minnesota this fall, one of my subjects is to talk about animal-facilitated therapy. And in the course of preparing for these lectures, and because of my interest in this subject, I read some of the early literature, and I read some of the history of the insane asylums, which are really terrible. Really terrible. They used to lock these people up and chain them up, and it's really, it makes you sick. And then there came along some Quakers, a large Quaker family in Yorkshire, in England. And this person realized that this isn't the way to go. And so he formed the York Retreat. And the York Retreat, and they obtained a physician who had more flexibility than the average, and he was their physician, and they did not bring people in to chain them up. They would even, the lady would have special tea for them, in which they would all dress up, and they would take, they would respect their differences, and instead of punishing them for acts they could not control, they would try to help them. And one of the most important things to me in my business was that they provided animals for these people. It was the first record of using animals in therapy for these people. And they had chickens and rabbits and other animals in a compound, and these people would then be charged with looking after them. And it was highly successful. But it really wasn't carried on or else recorded. Although, in a way, we did do this, didn't we? In some of our poor farms, in our old people's homes and all, we actually did, at least out west and also the reform schools, we did have animals. We had farms and cats and stuff. Because when I was growing up, I would judge cattle and other animals. And we would go to these places because they often had very good livestock. And it impressed me how these people were, although very strange to me, they were very diligent in their discharge of their duties. And I had it really impressed on me when it came time for my father and later my mother to go to the local retirement home in Stanwood, Washington, which is probably one of the more enlightened ones that I've ever seen. The people really look after them there, and most people just look forward to going there. But to my father, it was not very so happy. And it would have been far happier had they not earlier done a cost-benefit analysis without really good cost and benefit analysis and decided to get rid of the farm and the animals. And it's very pathetic that this is what has happened. It's also happened in many of the reform schools. They take the animals away. And as I spoke of last week, the importance of animals for people, it cannot be underestimated, and it changes their whole attitude on life, and they have something in an animal. They have not only responsibility, but they have warm fuzzies, which are necessary for us. For to the extent that we have been separated from animals, we are the poorer for it. And it has meant in prisons, it's changed the whole tenure of prisons. We are now getting animals into certain convalescent homes. In the Paradise Villa in Moscow, we got a cat, a mother cat in there several years ago, and then she had kittens, and then the party became very informal, and it changed the whole attitude of these people. And now we help them with a farm day every year when the 4-H's bring in their animals, and this last year we brought in sheep, and we also brought in a horse and a colt, which they could pet. They bring farm machinery in, and many of these people, you see, this is a rural setting, and it's just like old times for them, and it makes it's very important to them, and many of these people are disadvantaged. So this is a very unfortunate thing, and so where do we go from there? Well, with his background, when I went to the a University of California. I became interested in this, and as you know, we have been not very enlightened relative to employing these people. Yet we know that many jobs, a lot of people become very tired of boring duties. Sometimes people who have routine duties taking care of animals, they do not especially like it. One of the best animal attendants that I've ever had in all my experiences, and I maintain very large colonies of many kinds of animals in research. And there, among other things, we had over 1,000 beagles on long-term studies. And one of the best people we ever got was a mentally retarded boy. And you'll find out that many of these have a great empathy for animals, and also for them, and the animals for them. And this lad was not only harder working than most, but very diligent in his duties. And I always liked him in an audience when I spoke to them, because he'd sit up near the front and he always had a smile on his face. Even though he probably wasn't comprehending everything, he was really, really pleasant to have around, and a challenge to the others, because he did his work so well. And the animals loved him very much. And there's a place for him. And for him, this was the best thing that ever happened to him in his life. And his parents, who happened to be professional people, were exceedingly pleased with it. He was a different kind of a lad now. And also there, I hired a person called Robert Supersinski. This is a different kind of a disadvantaged person. Robert Supersinski was a tremendous large person. He was over 30 years old. He'd never held a job for very long in his life. He had been an alcoholic for a significant part of his life. And he had been a boxer, but people had used him and misused him. He was really a sad person as a person, although he himself had a fairly good outlook, because now he was in Alcoholics Anonymous, but very few people would take a chance on him. Well, I had a very good associate who unfortunately died before his time, but he was very good at handling people like this. His name was Boyd Harrell. And so I convinced Boyd that we should take him on as an animal attendant and other things. Turned out Robert Supersinski was exceedingly conscientious about this on his first job, and he became really a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous in that area, although he too died long before his time. He died just a few years ago after I left there. But this made a great change in him. And since that time, and coming to Pullman, I have been very impressed with this. How that there is a place in the community for them. Before I tell you about that, I'll never forget, and I don't want to lay a guilt trip on anybody, because I don't know how I would handle this myself, but in one of the first times I came here, I think in 1963 or something like that, maybe it's 64, a young pastor and his wife were here, and they had their firstborn along. And a block away, I could tell that the child was not a normal child, a so-called normal child. I could tell right away that he had Down syndrome. He was a mongoloid. And I had, and so the pastor, I guess as a result of one of my lectures or two, he sought me out to discuss this issue with him. And they had already, as a family, decided that they would keep this little lad in their home, and with love and attention give him this. And he was a significant member of the family and would continue to be so. Well, you have to probably, in some ways, be a very special parent. And to some of you, when you hear mongoloid, you say, well, they're, you know, that's a completely lost cause. Well, it was just 2 years ago that they were up here again, and they had him, they had other children who were what you'd call normal, I guess. And this lad now was, he was still going to school. He had learned to read a bit. This is a Mongoloid now with this very special attention from his parents. And he was adapting someone with the community. And he would have special classes, but he was in some regular classes. And if you wanted somebody to clean the tables in the dining hall here, no one could do it faster and more vigorously than he. I've never seen anybody wash a table with more vigor and faster than he. And he just loved to do it. He was handy to have around. And I thought it was most remarkable how these people had handled this. Now, in some situations, such children might be better off in an institutional setting. I'm not saying that. You have to be a special kind of a situation, because it is a very challenging thing. But it reminds me at this point to tell you something that I think is very important. And your cousin in Canada, Heather's sister. No.
Valerie,
yeah. Valerie was a member of a large family. And Valerie is, cerebral palsy probably. And it was one of, I think, some basis for great stress in the family, because the father really, I'm sure, wanted her institutionalized. And it was almost an embarrassment to him to have her around. But the mother, a very loving person, and her mother, who died at 95 or something, they felt that Valerie did not belong there. They gave her some special schooling. And she was a very sensitive person to music and a lot of other things. And she would be very embarrassing in a group if you did not know her and if you were so inclined, because Valerie might just start talking or mumbling or singing.
Or screaming.
Or screaming. But the point I want to make here is that some of these people cannot control themselves. There's no way they can control themselves. But that does not say that they might be registering everything you're doing and saying, yet they have no way to express and acknowledge that. Just as a person who might be in coma in the hospital, they might be completely out of it, but they're registering everything that's going on. There have been some very sad stories in this regard where people have been in coma. And the family is gathered for this last occasion, and they're splitting up the estate and deciding who's going to get what. And the person wakes up again, it has heard everything, and it is bitter for the next 10 years that this person survived. When a person is in coma, you never take a chance on anything like this. You should give only supportive kind of verbalizing and stroking, because they registered. And Valerie, fortunately, because of her mother, and I think to an extent her sisters and brothers who understood this, and her grandmother, which was so important to this, she has had, I think, a pretty good life. And I think they have always been kind to her. And where I first perceived this is when her other grandfather, the chief's uncle, would play, and she was really with it. Really with it.
Play a musical.
Musical instrument. And so that's one of the things that I don't want you to forget. And I had this impressed on me, for example, and I'll refer it in a couple more times here, but I often show up at churches on people have me into their church for weekend meetings, and sometimes they ask me to speak at the Sunday service and maybe have a study in between. And I think there were three services in this very large church in Western Washington, one of the largest churches there. And in one of the main services, there was an immigrant who would, I think he was from Norway, he would go down to the local home where there were some spastics. in their wheelchairs, and he would bring them in his van up there and bring them into church. And I remember they had two of them down there, and I was in the pulpit here, and I was watching the audience as I try to do, and people were, I think some of them, you know, they were accepted, but in others they were embarrassed by them, because they would, you know, they'd now and then articulate, but without controlling it, you see, they cannot help this, or they'd giggle at the wrong times. They could not control it, but it was obvious that they were understanding what I was saying and very appreciative of it. But we should not be embarrassed by these things. And the way not to become embarrassed with them is to spend some time with them. And I'll give you an illustration of this. Now we're in Pullman. And there again, I went to the local Epton Society, and one of the people we got is George. Now, I'm going to have a hard time sponsoring George. I got him originally on the CETA project. George is probably in his 50s, and that's just the best job he ever had, and he just hopes that he has this job forever. And George cleans up around the building, and sometimes he gets carried away and goes and cleans up around other buildings too. He doesn't always distinguish, but he's a very conscientious picker up of trash if you point them in the right direction. And once you point them in the right direction, they will be very conscientious about this and really enjoy it and appreciate it. And I also got a girl on CETA, and she really talked to those cats, and those cats loved her, and she was a cat attendant, and she would scold them and when they misbehaved, and it was really a kind of a riot. But she did very well there and obtained a better job because of her good service there. But the thing that I wanted to make a point of here was, and I'm going to leave some time for discussion because I'm sure many of you have had more experience in this than I. But one of my concerns has been, for example, in professional veterinary medical education, who we sign off and we do not discriminate for a lot of things, including physical handicap. Well, are you going to let a deaf person in, or can a person in a wheelchair make it? Can a blind person make it, you see? Well, I want to address some of that, and I'm looking at it for the health professions. We wrote a really remarkable grant to Linda Hine, who will be up here later, who has some of those responsibilities in our college. And it was a great grant, and everybody said it was a great grant, but nobody will fund it because they figured the other person ought to. But one of the things it did, first, in our whole building program, you have to sort of by law now, but I wanted everything together. So there was, all the buildings were connected, so that I in a wheelchair could enter one end of a building in one place, have access to that whole building and all buildings in our complex without going outside. Now I have some very articulate faculty that are very critical. Some of them are constructively critical. And one of them, who is usually very noisy about such things, he never said much until this last spring. We'll call this fellow Ron. It happens to be his name. And he is a very sensitive person, very active in the Catholic Church, and has, I think, great sensitivity. And one day he was advertising, because he's working on dwarfism and malmutes as a model for that disease in people, among other things. He's also in charge of radiology and other things. And he had advertised to find a good malmute male for his breeding calling. And a fellow showed up in a van. His name was Bob. And Bob had been a quadriplegic. And he told me about him because he knew my interest in this. And And he really liked the lad, and he seemed very bright. And so I made arrangements to meet Bob in Spokane, because I was speaking there to a large group, and I invited him in, and I took him to lunch, and then I took him into, no, his cost to have lunch with me was to listen to my speech, because it was on an important subject that I thought might be meaningful to him. And he drove up in his van. He had his dog with him. And his story is that he graduated from Western Washington State University in biology about 6 years ago. And then he went swimming with some friends in the Yakima River. And he dove in, and the water was only about this deep. And from there on, he couldn't feel anything from here. And he couldn't do anything below this. Well, that's a terrible thing to happen to anyone. And he worked at it for 5 years. This is the first job he's ever gotten since then. And I liked his spunk, I liked his attitude, and he was now able to handle one hand quite well and another hand fairly well, because he can drive his own pickup. He gets in his wheelchair, he rolls in, has an elevator, picks him up to the level of his panel truck, and he rolls up and is able to move himself into the driver's seat and run the whole van with his hands. And he has become our sonographer. A sonography is an ultrasound device. It's a remarkable thing, using ultrasound for diagnosis. X-ray is not very good for soft tissue. Sonography, you can see plaques in vessels and you can detect a pregnancy at 18 days, and they use it now a lot in human medicine. They usually most OBGYN people require an early sonogram on a pregnant woman, and then late in pregnancy, and it's non-destructive. Unlike X-ray, it's much preferred to X-ray, and you can really see what's going on. In fact, we had an interesting experiment with it, and Bob was involved in this. The veterinary students' wives, and I guess mates, I should say, because some of them are husbands now, because we have a lot of women in veterinary medicine. They have an association, and they wanted a tour of the clinic, and they wanted to hear about ultrasound and sonography. And it was February 13th this year. And we also got the technician came down from the hospital. And there was at least two women that were pregnant in the class, two of the students' wives. And one of them was about 7 months pregnant. And this was their firstborn. And she obtained permission from her physician to have this sonogram, and they wanted a boy, and they had already picked out names, and it was only 7 months, and so she stepped up to the sonogram, and Bob and his associate technician, they took pictures of it. They located the buttocks of the fetus, and then they isolated the scrotum area, and it was a scrotum which they pictured. And then she wrote on it, "Happy Valentine's." No, she named the child at the pick name they picked for the boy, and "Happy Valentine's," and that was her gift to her husband the next day. But we don't do that as a business. But Bob was part of this, and I frankly believe, I don't know if Bob will do it, but he's taking classes now, and I think that a person like that could become a veterinarian. I don't think you have to be able to wrestle a horse to become a veterinarian, you see, but this is one of the things we'd like to look at. I think we should look at professional education to see where people can really contribute well, not necessarily doing all of these things, but because they don't have to do all these things in a profession. We've just gone through a thing now, haven't we, about a girl, or can a deaf girl be a nurse? And it went to the Supreme Court, didn't it? And I think that was not the case to try. It wasn't a good case. But I am not convinced that a deaf girl cannot become a nurse. And I'd like to just address that briefly now. No, but let me finish with Bob. We formed the Pet People Partnership Council. And a member of this council is Bob Ewing, because Bob and I are trying to figure out, among other things, in the riding for the handicapped, we also want to drive for the handicapped. So a person like Bob, there's no way he can ride a horse. See? I mean, I don't know quite how he would. But he just loved to drive a horse. See? And we're trying to figure out an apparatus on the back of a jog cart where he can just roll his, it would be light, but would hold securely his wheelchair so he could go up in a part of it, and then he could drive the horse. See? The same with older people. See, so they could go out and drive a horse around our track and stuff. It'd be really fun. I'd like to go with him. But in this meeting, that was another meeting. We also have, I have a handicapped council. And as you might, knowing me, you'd know that I'd have to be chairman to deal with my handicaps. But we, and we have several people on it. A blind person, a fellow that doesn't hear very well. Bob is on it, and so is this fellow Ron. And after the first meeting, I really felt good about this, because he usually doesn't tell me very many things I do right. Maybe it's because I don't do very many things right. But after the meeting, he says, you know, when you said you were going to have a complex here where you had all the buildings connected so you didn't have to go outside to get between buildings. He said, I thought you were crazy. He says, I don't know anybody that couldn't go between buildings. But you see, this is where Bob works. And we went through a very difficult winter this year. And this is one of the things I had in mind. And I don't know if you pushed a wheelchair on a hill that's all ice, or tried to, in a wheelchair, get through two-foot piles of snow. It's just impossible. Well, Ron was one of the people that pushed this fellow in the wheelchair. See, the point of this story is, you don't really, it's just like the Indian said, until you've gone 2 miles in the moccasins, you don't know what's going on. And until you know as a friend, a blind person, a deaf person, a person in a wheelchair, you don't really know what's going on. You really don't know until you've ridden one of them. Huh? One of my staff broke his leg. He's an anesthesiologist, and he's a very big guy. And the horse rolled on him and broke his leg, and boy, it was really bad. I said there's only one thing worse, if Paul would have rolled on the horse. But and the horse got up, and he was out and won races again. But Paul isn't going to win any more races. But Paul ended up in a wheelchair. So he then got some appreciation for this, too. About this Ron Sandy, he says, and now I understand why you want these buildings connected. And he wholeheartedly approves it, because he had been pushing this wheelchair and found out it wasn't really built for it. And our own physical plant forces don't realize, because in our new building, we had a nice place for him to pull up his panel and a gentle slope up to the building to get into our new building. Except they didn't plow that. That wasn't on the priority list until I got after them. So, and then you don't think about things like, what if there's a fire on the fourth floor? The fire alarm on the fourth floor. You know what happens when the fire alarm goes on the fourth floor? The elevators stop. Now, how are you going to get down the stairs if you're a paraplegic in a wheelchair? Well, so I make arrangements then that he is to appoint two people who are with him, whether it's a class or something, that even a fire alarm, they are assigned to take him down the stairs. But you have, unless you've been there, you don't think of these things until it happens. Huh? All right, now, we have a deaf person, I mean a blind person, on this handicapped committee. Right, so I send out notices, or I send out the minutes. Yeah. I started to send them out. I said, this is crazy. Yeah. You're going to get my handwritten note. Some people have reading it even when they got eyes. You know, no way he's going to read that. So what do? You send them a tape, huh? You send them the tape. You can hear it. So as I remind you of that. Now, I went to a handicapped session over, it was run by the federal government. There's some people who are very concerned about this. A fellow named Mark Ozer, who we've been helping out on this, and he's very committed to this. And it was really great because he brought two people there who I spent some time with. When I go to these conferences, I try to get close to these people, and maybe go to lunch with them. And one day I went to lunch with a blind person, and the next day I went to lunch with a deaf person. Now this was a very remarkable deaf person. In this session were the pharmacists and others, and I approached the pharmacy because the dean of pharmacy, Dean L. White, was very interested in this too. And he said, there's no way that a blind person could ever be in pharmacy. You'd have to change everything to Braille on all the drugs, and a lot of it goes by color changes and all that. There's no way. And there was a pharmacist there, and he opened this up when the blind person was there. And he says, what's your problem? And he went through some of the things I've told you. And he says, well, he said, it may surprise you. He says, I started a chemical company. And this guy is really profoundly blind. And he says, I couldn't afford a chemist, although I was trained in it. I couldn't afford, so I had to do a lot of my own chemistry. He says, I did my own chemistry. I don't know whether it was 15 or 20 years. And he showed him how, you weigh things and how you do it. Now, it almost blew my mind to hear him tell how he did these things. And his problems. And he also told me that when he was flying out for this trip from Baltimore, he lives in Baltimore, and he said, he was sitting not in the aisle seat, and the stewardess came along. And the fellow next to her says, she said to the fellow next to him, says, what do you want to drink? And then when he came to him, she saw he was deaf. And says, what would you like to have? She changed her voice.
He was blind.
And he was blind, yeah. But she changed.
Yeah.
Oh, a deaf. No, this is a blind person. But he's a blind person. Obviously blind. He has his cane, you see. But the stewardess treats him differently. When there's nobody going across, if you have a seeing eye dog and you're at a light, the dog goes by the traffic. And if there's no traffic, he's got a problem, see. And seeing this, I went up to him and offered to take him across. But don't do it any more than you have to. Huh? And when you're going to offer him a drink, you don't speak in a different voice. Or to a deaf person, especially one who reads lips, you don't want to talk special to them and enunciate every word so clearly, because they're going to goof them up with your lips. Huh? You're not saying it so a lip reader can read it. And he says, there's also some advantages to being blind. It's like my friend, in fact, is a physician who went through and became a physician. And he was blind when he graduated. And what is it? White Cane, White Coat or something. I think the book is out. And in there he recalls that the people were really feeling sorry for him because it was a beautiful day and he was in swimming. But he couldn't see all these pretty girls. And as he crawled out of the tank, he says, boy, he says, I felt more pretty girls today than any time in my whole life. And they were jealous of him. Well, or he recalls, he was walking along the street one day with a couple, and they admired some girls across the street. And then they were giving him a bad time and saying, too bad you can't see him. And he says, says, you can't do what I can do. He says, you know, I have to get close enough so I can do something. He can put his hands on him and get by with it, you see, and pat him on the shoulder at least, and that was not very good for people who can see. So he said there were some disadvantages, or some advantages, and you might be interested to know, when I asked him if he were to have a choice, because my wife and I got into this one day, many, many years ago, and we were debating if we had to lose one of our senses, which one would we lose? And there was no question in my mind. I couldn't stand to lose my eyesight. And it really shocked me when the chief said, well, if she had to lose something, she'd prefer to lose her sight than her hearing. And so I asked this blind man this. Oh, he says, sir. He says, losing your eyes is no problem. I should say he lost his at 10, yeah, in an accident, an arrow. And he says, no, losing one's sight isn't really a big issue. He says, but I couldn't stand to lose my hearing. Well, that brings you then to the hearing. Now the people, the blind people, have had a far better press. And there isn't so much difficulty on their recognition of a lot of things. They have their seeing eye dogs and everything, don't they? The hearing people, and there's probably 14 million people in the United States today who have defective hearing. And there's a million or two or three maybe that are profoundly deaf. Well, I went out for lunch then with this person who is a physician. And he's a deaf physician. And he was born this way. Now he has two hearing aids, so he can pick up just a little bit. But he's a lip reader, but he can hear a little bit there. And he was a very interesting fellow. He took his pre-med, way back in early 60s. He just finished medicine 2 or 3 years ago. He was 11 years getting into the School of Medicine. He finally got into Rutgers. And then he told the people about the various techniques now we have for one who can't hear, you know, the teletypewriter and just a lot of things that you can do. And I've been analyzing our professional education. And you're really, in some things, you're better off with a visual readout from sound than you are listening, really. You're probably more accurate. And we have a lot of those devices now, so you could be very, very good at this. And he told me a couple of interesting things. But he also pointed out how the deaf, because they've been separated off and all, they have a very low opinion of themselves. You know, they make brooms or something, I guess. I don't know. But he said that one of the common things that happen in a hospital, people call up and give orders to the physician, or they give a message to the physician, and they hear and say okay. And in one study that he cited, there was probably about a 30% error in these. Maybe they were to call a number, 332-1353, and they call back 1532. That's a very common error of those of us who hear well. We make a lot of mistakes. He says, I have never made this kind of a mistake. He says, I can't afford to. But he says, whenever I get a message like this, I always repeat it and write it down. And so I have never made a mistake. The other thing he told me, I said, how do your patients regard you? Well, he says, that's very interesting. He says, I have never had a person, he says, I have only been questioned and had my proficiency questioned by only one group of people, and they are the deaf. The deaf don't believe I'm for real. They don't think a person can make it as a physician and be deaf. And I think that's a very sad commentary, because I think with our capabilities now, we have opening up far more possibilities to them to do this, and I'm hoping that we can do more of this in the health professions. And that's why I'm happy, for example, in the hearing dog program. And I talked to you about a ranger when I visited with Mrs. Christensen at Gig Harbor on the follow-up on the placement of Ranger, who was a hearing dog, but she needed even more, as she said, a companion. But her hearing dog is her freedom in a way, because he knows when the phone rings, and so she can do something about that. He tells her when there's somebody at the door. He tells her when there's maybe a burglar, when the smoke alarm gets up, and he tells her when to get up in the morning when the alarm goes off. And they're now official in many places, but many people don't recognize this. They don't recognize that an orange collar and an orange leash is an official hearing dog. Now, I would like to go to Europe for a trip with you, and I have, before I do that, because one of the people that went on our trip in 71 was our daughter Becky and our daughter Karin and Chief and I. And we visited many places. But I should tell you that Becky is involved in special education. I'll never forget when I visited her in Brainerd, Minnesota, where she worked for 4 years with the profoundly handicapped, which is it's a challenge that few people can take for very long. But I was very grateful that she was there. And if you want to go to Brainerd, you really got to want to go to Brainerd. And I flew in there in a Ford Trimotor one Saturday night and landed there. I think it was March. The ice was still on some of the streams. And she met me there, and before we went to dinner, she wanted to show me her charges. And we went down to the hospital, and here they were lined up. They were being tucked into bed and before the lights went out. And when Becky showed up, it was as if Santa Claus had come. And she went from each bed and told me about each one, called them by name, tickled some, and stroked some others, and it was very obviously they loved her very much. But then she also told me that for some of them, she and her associates were the only ones they had that loved them. Their parents had left them and hardly ever show up. And so I'm grateful that she is there, or she was there. She's in another situation now. And I'm grateful for those people who take upon themselves this charge, the special creatures of God. Now, in Europe, I wanted to show her Bethe Stollen, and I wanted to see Bethe Stollen myself, because Erling Stordal, who is a blind musician and very famous in Norway, established the Sportsplatz, really a place for the disabled, up on the Valdres north of Oslo, where they teach the blind to ski and ride horses, and anybody handicapped can qualify to come there. And they use a lot of physical therapy, but they use animals. They also have dogs there. And I wanted to see that. And they use horseback riding because that's so very good for, it's better than physical therapy for some ailments, and it's very good for epileptics. Unfortunately, I didn't go by Beto, and I wish I would have with my family at that time. Beto is the most remarkable place that I've ever visited on planet Earth. And I knew about it for a long time, and I became very much cognizant of it when I talked to Edna Hong about it and read her book, A Bright Valley of Love, which is really a required reading for everybody. And she hinted in there that they used animals in therapy. And then the Hinderleys had been there and thought it was the nearest thing to the kingdom of God they had ever seen. And then Alex Funke, who's the director, now he's retiring, was here. He was a prisoner in this country when I was a prisoner in Germany. And I would have traded him places had I been able to do that. But he was here and told about Beethoven. Some of his tapes are in there. They're really fantastic. But I would like to tell you a little bit about my visit there. It started in 1867, about 112 years ago, because some Christians in Westphalia decided that attics and back rooms were not the appropriate place to keep the disadvantaged, the epileptics. And they thought it was their Christian duty to heed the call. And so they established this little village where the premise was that they lived with them. And it grew in a way prospered. They never closed the front door. Anyone who needs help can come there. Even just for overnight, they will always give them a bed and give them some food. If they're able to work, they must work. 80% of the people there have some kind of a task. Maybe for some it's very simple. Maybe it's soaking postage stamps that we send them from all over the world and taking them off the paper backing. They sold 2 years ago 200,000 marks worth of stamps, and all the money went to support a mission in Tanzania. Well, they started in 1867 and with this program in mind. They finally called a person named Bodelschwing. Old Father Bodelschwing, in 1871. And he was a genius in not only in agricultural practice and other things, but since that time, since early days, he built a good foundation. And then his son after him, they are now in excess of 5,000 people disadvantaged there, over 5,000 people to take care of them. They have a home for deacons, deaconesses, and a school for deaconesses, a theological seminary, a modern hospital with research facilities to look at epilepsy and other things. It is absolutely a fantastic place. And when I had supper with Alex Funke when I was there, he told me many things. But two things I will tell you about it. He said, "We understand our mission here to be a simple one. Everyone who comes here must understand from us. We must make them understand that God loves them. And our philosophy is that the patients are the professors." And that has been the philosophy for a long time. Now, a little bit background on Bodelschwing. The Father Bodelschwing, he worked, so he knew what it was to be disadvantaged because he was when he became a pastor, he was in sort of the slums of France because many Germans were the laborers in France, like the Southern Europeans are in Germany today. They were working, picking up the garbage and stuff in Paris. And his job was the mission to these. And then he got a parish. And within a matter of 11 days, his four children died with an infectious disease. And a man came up after the death of the fourth one, and he told him, "God will replace your children." He then got a call to go to Beethoven. And there they started another family. And when the fourth child was born, their second four, when Fritz was born, this person who had seen them so many years ago and said, "God will replace your family." And he hadn't seen him for, I guess, since then. He showed up that day and called on him. Well, that was his launching. And he had very great success, but through difficult times. And then Fritz Bodelschwing replaced him in 1911. That was the boy that was born, his fourth one. And Fritz was truly a remarkable person. Even today, if you talk to some of the old-timers, as I talk to my friend Rickard, And Rickard is a spastic, but when you mention Fritz Vogelschwing, I mean, he almost jumps out of his pad. He can't contain himself. And some people say that's where Hitler lost the war. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. But when I went there, and then they took me around to these many places. My host, who is their public relations person, Friedhelm Huki, he in fact worked with Muggeridge. And when Muggeridge was doing the Third Testament, the story on Dietrich Bonhoeffer was there at Bethel, and Friedhelm Huki worked with Muggeridge on it. And Muggeridge was very impressed, as everyone is, with the place. But he took me around to House Ebenezer and a lot of other places. And wherever I went, these people would greet me like a long-lost brother. I have never had a warmer greeting from anywhere than from the patients at Bethel. And when I went to the House Ebenezer, he showed me, they were just coming down to eat, and people were, blind person, I know, greeted me and had quite a discussion with me, and there was a lot of epileptics there in the halt and all, and they told me about their plans for eating, and they had certain tables depending on their weight and other things and what they should eat. And while they were eating, they took me upstairs and showed me the cubicles where these people lived, and all the braille, the big braille library for the blind man. And then they took me another little cubicle, and they very proudly showed me, there's two of them, they stayed in there, one very simple person who was very fond of little play cars, little model cars, and he had a lot of them stacked up on a makeshift shelf. But they were looking forward to the next day because it was his birthday. And they had just put up a beautiful cupboard, well constructed with sliding doors. And they proudly opened up the door and showed me it also had a light switch in it so he could see his cars. That was for his cars. This was his birthday gift, and it was going to be a big celebration. One of the big things here is that they celebrate. They have a lot of celebrations. I wish I could tell you about more of them. And then when we finished there, we came out on the platform to go downstairs to the, if you've been at House Ebenezer, you know, there's some stairs there, kind of a large meeting area before you go into the kitchen. And a lot of them had gathered there now because they were through with their meal. And one of them was Rickard. And Rickard was in his pad on a mobile kind of thing. And he caught sight of me up there, and he's one of these people, like, was in that church I told you about, because they can't control their arms. He has mittens on his hands because so he doesn't scratch himself and destroy himself. And he's been on this thing all his life, I suppose, more than 55 years. And he caught sight of me, and he wondered, he was asking them who I was, and I was from America, from the United States, and he became very excited. And then he found out I was a veterinarian, and then he became very excited because he had many questions for me. And I should tell you that probably why from the United States he was excited, because many people come there as volunteers to work, and some young ladies from some school had been there, and they'd worked long and hard with Rickard to try to fix it so he could at least be able to kind of sit up a little bit. It'd be easier to watch television and other things. And they had worked with him for a long period of time so that he was able to just kind of back like this, he could sit up a little bit. They were from the United States, see. So that's why I suppose that he was excited. But he was excited to find out more about animals, because I suppose he'd watched television and all, and he says, do you ever work on birds? Are you ever able to make them fly again if they break their wings? How do you give therapy to fish? And so it went, you see, because he's a very intelligent person, and it was, I could tell that my host was very anxious that I meet Rickard. And then he wanted pictures of our college, and his last question to me was, do you employ any Indians in your College of Veterinary Medicine? Well, I do, and rather than to get into whether they're Native Americans, which are very popular in West Germany today, or Indian from India. I didn't get into it there until I left him. And they joked with him, and they had a good time. He's a very happy guy. And as we walked away, Friedhelm told me that, he says, what I didn't tell you. No, I asked him, what kind of Indians? Oh, he says, they're Indians from India. You see, he's very interested in Indians from India. In fact, he supports a little child in India. And I had to call for a rephrasing of that answer, because I could not conceive of Rickard, who had spent all his time, all his life on this little gurney, could be supporting a little child in India. And he says, yeah, what I didn't tell you is that he has control of his right foot, and he paints very beautiful pictures, and we sell these pictures, and all the money goes to support this little child in India. Well, I correspond with Rickard, and I have a couple letters here. In fact, I've just written him recently, because this story has a great impact, and I'll tell you a little more about that. But and he's really a great guy, and I have pictures of him here. You can see if you want to see him, and one of his pictures. They cut up a lot of them into small, and then they have them as postcards. You see. but the story doesn't end there. Because you see, Rickard really isn't supposed to be here, because Hitler put out the order that all of these who were less than normal people would be put to death. And Fritz von Bolschwing, of course, was exceedingly distressed with this. And he did everything to try to prevent it. He did not fill out the forms for all their patients that he was supposed to, so they sent people in to fill out the forms. And he appealed to the high command of the Third Reich. Even to Hermann Göring, he got an unsatisfactory answer from him. And then one day, Dr. Brandt, who was Hitler's personal physician, came with some of his associates to make the final arrangements. You see, what Bodelschwing had done, he had followed in the papers that these other places where they had handicapped people, and he noted that the obituary column was getting longer because they were, in fact, putting them to death. And so he showed up, and the story I have on it is that he got Dr. Brandt off by himself. I think he was also prepared for it from the standpoint that he had one of his handicapped people who was playing a great hymn of the church on his trumpet, and he played a very mean trumpet as they drove up. And he took him off to the side and asked him, you know, what makes a person human? And he says it's their ability to communicate. And so Bodelschwing took him to House Patmos, where they keep their most serious cases. And he says, come with me. And so he took him there. And I don't know all the ones that he showed him. Maybe it was Henrietta, who was mentally retarded. She was an epileptic, and she was a hydrocephalic with a big head. And I don't know if you've seen very many of these, but if you've seen one, it's enough for you probably. It's one too many. But she was sleeping when he came, and so he went up and stroked her on the head, and she turned over, and on seeing von Bodelschwing, a big smile on her. And he probably went to Adolf. Now, Adolf knew about three things. He knew von Bodelschwing, and he could really appreciate food and colors, and these would delight him. In fact, Bodelschwing said, although as busy as he was, he would often go to Patmos because he could really learn how one should appreciate his food from Adolf and colors, and he says he learned much from these people. And so it went. And when he finished, he just turned around to Dr. Brandt and he says, now you may not be able to communicate with these people, but it should be obvious to you that I can communicate with them, that we can communicate with them. And with that, he walked out. Dr. Brandt with him got back to headquarters, and Dr. Brandt announced that they would cease their negotiations and leave. He told his associates, and they left. And no one was harmed at Bethel. No one was touched. Now, they didn't get any support from the state, but every morning there would be parcels at the front door. Well, why? Well, these people had taken out time to communicate with those who are difficult to communicate with. Otherwise, they would have been dead. Ricard knows that. And that's why, for example, when I was in Germany a year and a half ago, when it was really terrible times, you'd be taken off your airplane under machine gun and they'd search everything because the gangsters were out. And it was such a roadblock in which Friedhelm Huki was way out down on the Autobahn one day, and he was stopped by the police and the army. And they were searching everyone. And the policeman came up and he looked at his license, and then he says, "We must search your entire car. You must open up the trunk." And then he stopped and he says, "Oh, are you from Von Bodelschwing Clinic?" He says, "Yes." And then you will go on. You see, part of the reason that I say that this is where Hitler lost the war, it was probably evident to his associates that people knew what was going on at Bethel. That people were devoted to helping these people and to have destroyed them. And that work, Bodelschwing probably had really more influence in many ways to the people than in a way that Hitler had, you see. At the Nuremberg trials, when Dr. Brandt was put to death for his complicity in the sins of the Third Reich, he stated that probably the most impressive person he had ever met was von Bodelschwing, person that impressed him the most. Well, I just had a letter from him a while back, because a fellow who I've come to know and like very much is a fellow named Colonel Irwin, Jim Irwin. Some of you probably know him from TV, because he in the Apollo 12 or 4? He was a person with another guy that rode all over the moon and paid for it dearly, because his heart gave out on him. And he is now essentially a cardiac cripple, although he's still traveling all over the world. And he's had a triple bypass. Cooley down at MD Anderson gave him a triple bypass. But he was scheduled to go to Russia, and he was supposed to drop by Germany. And I told him about the greatness of Bethel, and he's going to try to see him. So I wrote to Rickard about it, that he might come by. And Rickard wrote back. He was certainly looking forward to that, because he had some technical questions to ask him about it, because he'd watched, you see. But I'm really disappointed, because he had to change his trip. But I keep pressing on him that he must go by there and see them, and he said he would. I'm sorry I talked too long, but I'm telling you where I'm coming from. Now, where you're coming from is probably far better, but I happen to be on the program today. Do any of you want to correct me where I'm wrong? And yes?
I don't want to correct you, but I wanted to add something to you. Edna Hong had come up to Alaska and was at a retreat with us, and she shared right now. After she left there, several of us encouraged her to go to the Whaley Center, which is dealing with these spastic children and that. And I, again, had the privilege of speaking with her later, and she said, you have your own Bigfoots right here in Alaska. And I wanted you to know that on the school board, we were able to get through that these children are not to be removed from the system, but they should be in the system. And in Bartlett High School in Alaska, and it is working, quote, unquote, they have 20 of these mentally retarded children. They are not in the same classes with the student, but they are in the halls with the student, in private classrooms, in the facility, but they function as normal, quote, that word, normal children in the system. And it is a successful program. We see a lot in this, and it's really, any of you who are on education, I would encourage you not to separate these children from that. Some of the greatest joys that we have are in this.
For the benefit of the so-called normal children, probably more than the handicapped.
Right.
I'll never forget my visit to Alaska at an All Lutheran conference. I talked about some of these things, and I told them about Rickard and this. And then I said, there's a very important book on this, Ed Nohong's Bright Valley of Love, and the people clapped. And it was a great thrill for me because I had a tape of it, and I sent it to Ed Nohong.
I used to conduct camps for handicapped kids, and I used as counselors high school and college students who were willing to come in and give a week or two of their lives to learn. And they weren't paid, I never paid them, it was kind of like holding on that score. And I knew that at the end of each camp, it was the high school or college counselor that had gained. The handicapped kid had had a fun week, perhaps, but there was the others that I felt that I had done something for. And I think here's where we're failing, both in our educational system and the medical world certainly is failing, because they give very little support to a family that has a handicapped child born to them. I remember sitting with a family whose family doctor and whose family pastor and social worker said, this child must go to an institution. So they listened and they did what they were told. 18 years later, that same person was told in my hearing, why, what kind of parents were you? Why did you send Judy to the institution? She should never have been here. In other words, our society had changed during those 18 years, but it failed to realize that this set of parents had to go through all the traumas involved. And I think we in the United States, I spent almost a year working in the institutions in Sweden after I had been to Beethoven. And I felt that we were so far behind that I was very, very upset. And I said so to one of my Swedish relatives who put me straight. I come from Montana. They said, remember, Sweden is the same size as Montana. Why shouldn't we do a better job than your whole entire big nation should? Which is true, but I still think our church is failing. Our educational systems are failing because they're not making people understand the things that you're talking about here. But this is just a very small segment. How can we get into our churches? How many do you see in our pews? You don't see them in our pews. I've spoken at our Ladies' Aid groups, call them that because they're called different names by different synods. You don't see them in the pews. They're not there. Why aren't they there? They should be there. Federal legislation says we must now educate every single child, irregardless of his handicap. And most states say they must be streamlined. And I'm in favor of streamlining, not just saying that they meet in the halls. I don't believe in that. They should be in the classroom, and that's where they belong. And mainstreaming does work, it has worked, and it will work. But I think we're failing in our training institutions to train people, and that's why I gave up on the adults and started working with high school and college students. And I was fortunate enough to be in a position and a job where I could fund this kind of a process. And the process was worth it. I used my vacations that way for every summer, and it was worth every bit of it.
Yeah, it's very, and I'll get to you. I want to bring up this, that people, I think, now are more sensitive to it. I sense this. I always give about two or three commencement addresses, and it may vary from, I did it at Colodas High School, and there were five graduates, and I made a point of that. They got me a year ahead, and I felt I should do this. But two of them this year, I included in this, the story of Rickard. And in the Seneca High School in Maryland, out of Frederick, Maryland, there must have been 2,500 people there. And when I finished, they all stood up. I think I attribute it. The same thing happened at Big Bend Community College. Of course, they had a little guy who was in a wheelchair. Now, the other thing I want to bring out is that very important thing. You know, that's a vegetable there. You know, there's nothing there. And I'll never forget the story told at Beethoven in this regard. I think her name was Hulda. And this retired nurse was there, sort of the house mother for this. And she got a letter one day from Hulda's father. And he said, I pray every day that God will take Hulda. Because Hulda, all she did was lay in this bed and look out at people. But she had big, beautiful brown eyes. And so the nurse sat right down and wrote him a letter right back by return mail and said, do not pray that God will take Hulda. Because sometimes our patients here become very violent. And the only way that we are able to settle them down is to seat them in front of Hulda. And she looks at them with those big, beautiful brown eyes. And that's the only thing that settles them down. Yes.
I guess I wanted to share a little bit about a place called Camp Oakhurst, which is in Oakhurst, New Jersey. It's a camp for the physically handicapped, pretty advanced. They've been in the business for quite a while. And they have...
How do you spell that? How do you spell it?
Oakhurst. O-A-K-H-U-R-S-T.
Okay. Oakhurst, yeah.
Oakhurst. And I spent 3 summers there, and I really learned a lot there. I mean, I learned so much more about life in the sense that when someone tells me that they can't do something, in that place it was proven to me that there wasn't such a thing. We also ran an orientation program for all the new staff for 1 week, and we would assign handicaps to groups of people. And then at the end of the day, you would discuss what you felt like and how it was to be fed, how it was to be tossed around, pushed your wheelchair from behind you, not telling you that you were going to another activity. It was like kind of just like pushing you along. And the sensitivity that came out of that. And as I was working along there, there were 2 people, and one reminded me a lot of your friend, and his name was Bernie Light, and he was spastic CP also, but had a mind and he could write beautifully, and he would type with his foot, and he would have socks on his hands because he would scratch his whole face. Then there was another kid, well, he was an adult, but there was a kid there that was named by Eric Mizell, which was a thalidomide kid. He only had 2 stumps and 2 arms. I mean, didn't have arms, but stumps for arms. And he would do everything. I mean, he would put on his clothes, play football, he would put it between his neck, or play baseball, putting a bat between his neck and shoulder, and even would go into the 9 feet area of the pool and dive in, and people would just have heart attacks to see him go down in there. But he wasn't afraid of anything, and he could do everything. He was capable of doing so many more things that I've seen people, quote unquote, that are normal with a total body. So I think that's an education that all of us were going through here, and we can learn more and more as we start to look at these people. And I think the part that I'm trying to emphasize is they don't want sympathy, they want empathy. And once you understand them, they want you to understand them as a person and come down to their level, and you'll appreciate what they have.
You up to theirs.
Right, not you down to theirs.
I work for a school district.